Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koff, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high quality investigative and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by Emily Vader. She is a health reporter for the Monitor who's been focused in recent years on reporting on substance use and mental health issues around the state. Her most recent series, which she has been reporting on for many months now, almost a year, is on treating addiction in Maine's jails. The series was generously supported by the Pulitzer Center. So Emily, I want to jump right in here, and I want to start by talking about the origin of this series of stories. How did you conceive of it?
Yeah, so I have been tracking the opioid settlement money for years now, and a couple of years ago, for the first time, I heard a county official call the requirement that Maine's jails provide medication-assisted treatment an unfunded mandate. And that was still top of mind when a year later I was sorting through officials' responses to another survey on opioid settlement money and noticed the same pattern that more than half of Maine's 16 counties had used some of their funds to pay for medication-assisted treatment in the jails. So that got me wondering, one, why this is, and two, how county-run jails are funded, and three, how prisoners' medical needs, particularly when it comes to addiction, have affected county budgets.
Yeah, and so this is actually, I think, maybe counterintuitive for some people, but jails are actually kind of a pivotal point, a pivotal public health point, and they can be an important place to reach people. How have prisoners' medical needs grown in recent years, and what kind of health issues are jail officials seeing?
Yeah, so county officials have estimated that about 75% of the people in county jails have a substance use disorder, about 60% have a mental health disorder. And many of the people that are coming into custody are not only dealing with severe addiction and mental illness, but other medical needs like untreated diabetes. There's a lot of necrotic skin wounds from a drug called xylazine that's found in a lot of street drugs. And so for a lot of these people, jails are the first place where they have access to healthcare. A lot of the people are experiencing homelessness or they don't have health insurance, and jails are required to provide for their medical needs. And so that's the first time a lot of people are getting attention. And the officials that run the jails told me that over the past decade or so, the acuity of prisoners' medical and mental health needs has really increased in tandem with the rising lethality of street drugs like fentanyl and methamphetamine.
So people are really coming into these jails a lot sicker and with a lot more complicated needs, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, most people, I certainly was not familiar with how county jails are funded. Talk to us a little bit about funding for county jails. Where does that money come from? What percentage of it is by the county? What percentage of it comes from the state? And then I'd like to go into a little bit about what all of these, you know, treating all of these health needs for these inmates is costing, and who's paying that cost. So let's start with what the split is.
So at its most basic level, you have county jails are funded by tax dollars, by revenues from boarding from other jails or sometimes federal prisoners, state support, and then other sources of funding like grant money or contracts from the state or the federal government. How much it's costing jails to provide addiction treatment, a report by the Maine County Correction Professional Standards Council that was published in January estimated that the 15 county-run jails spent about $12.6 million on addiction and mental health treatment last year. And this is through that mix of funding, tax dollars, grant funding, other temporary funding streams. Since 2022, the state has provided $20.3 million to be split among all of the jails. And that number hasn't changed much since. There have been a couple of one-time appropriations, including earlier this year. The Maine Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Corrections have provided counties millions of dollars in grants and contracts over the years, specifically for medication-assisted treatment. But still, counties say that state support is not adequate to cover the cost of the required services like addiction treatment. And they've been really pushing in recent years to increase that annual jail operations fund, but have not made much success. So I put this question to the spokesperson for Governor Janet Mills, who told me in a statement that the administration has heard county officials' concerns about the funding, and they're working with the legislature to make additional appropriations like the one I mentioned that happened earlier this year. But she said that the state has limited authority over county-run jails. So there's only so much that the administration feels that they have in their power to do.
Yeah, that is complicated, right? Now, so let's talk about what is actually going on in terms of providing medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder in the jails. We have 15 county-run jails in Maine, and they have been legally required to provide this treatment since 2019. You visited four different jails around the state and you talked to people at all of them. Give us a sense of how the jails are approaching this differently, depending on where they are.
Yeah, so I think this is actually a good time to go back and clarify that in Maine, at least, jails are county run. Prisons, which is usually where people go after they're sentenced, those are run by the state. And in jails, usually people can get sentenced to a jail, but it's usually less than 9 months to a year, I believe. However, as you've probably read in the Monitor, over the last several years, there have been a huge backlog of cases, and due to the indigent defense system, there's just simply not enough lawyers, there's not enough judges. So people are sitting in jails for longer periods of time as they're waiting simply for a trial or for their sentencing. So that's important context to keep in mind, that jails are feeling very overwhelmed with the population they're dealing with. And there is some data to back that up, showing that there are an increasing number of bookings every year, meaning more people are coming being processed through the jails. So, yeah, so I did v visit four different jails. I went to Cumberland, Franklin, Piscataquis, and Aroostook. Cumberland is the largest jail in the state, and Piscataquis is the smallest jail in the state. And basically, jails are providing medication-assisted treatment in two different ways, either providing a daily oral medication, and that's the majority of the jails. This daily oral medication is a combination of buprenorphine and naloxone. It's commonly known by its brand name, Suboxone. And these medications, they're effective in helping curb opioid cravings and withdrawal symptoms, but they only provide about 24 hours of protection. One provider at one of the jails said that people have a lot of anxiety as they sort of approach that 24-hour point, because withdrawal symptoms can be just deeply uncomfortable. It's not necessarily life-threatening, but it is. Think of the worst flu you've ever had, and think of the threat of that coming on every 24 hours. And so it's really difficult for people to deal with that. But these medications are a lot cheaper than what two of the jails are doing. So two jails, Franklin and Somerset counties, they have started to provide extended release injectable buprenorphine. Those are available under the brand name Sublocade and Brixadi. And these shots provide about a month of coverage. So they're significantly different than these daily medications. They are, however, much more expensive. But this month of protection is really great, not only for that, to avoid that 24-hour anxiety, but when people leave the jail, when they're released, they then have a sort of a protection period so that they can get connected to a new provider who can make sure that they have their medications and they're not immediately scrambling for their medications right away. And that's also, I mean, we'll get to this later, but there's a huge risk of overdose after people leave jail. So, but again, only two jails are providing this, Franklin and Somerset.
What is the barrier to providing this for the other jails? Do they want to do this and it's just too expensive? Like what are they saying in the other places that aren't doing this?
Yeah, I think everyone would love to do this if they could. In fact, several jail officials have said as much, but again, it's much more expensive. A single shot of Sublocade or Brixadi costs anywhere from $1,500 to $1,900, and a month's worth of the daily oral medication. Either there's a pill that goes under the tongue or a strip that goes under the tongue. That costs anywhere from $250 to $750 for the entire month. So it costs twice as much to provide these shots. So they would like to, but it's hard. They're finding it difficult to find funding to do this. Although Franklin and Somerset have found the funding. And we can get into this in a little bit, but basically Franklin and Somerset are using federal grant money and federal and state grant money and opioid settlement funds to make this possible.
Yeah, I do want to get into the specific funding a little bit later on, but I think first maybe we should back up and just so you describe in the stories the actual sort of process for giving the people the daily medication in particular. Take us through what that looks like.
Yeah, so I will give the example of the Piscataquis County Jail. When I visited, I asked them to take me exactly through what they do. So there is not really a medical space. There's a medical exam room that's literally in a closet, but that's really for specific circumstances. In terms of daily medical administration, they call it med pass. Prisoners are taken one by one out of their pod. That's where their beds are. That's their sort of like the residential area. They're taken one by one by a corrections officer into the booking area. They're sat across from a corrections officer at the desk. The officer will check the medical record, double check it, and then if the medications include a medication assisted treatment or medications for opioid use disorder, they're going to crush those. There's literally like a machine where they crush them. If they're the pills, if they're the strips, they're just handing it to them.
Why are they crushing them? Just so.
These are really easy to, well, in the words of officials, it's hard, it's easy for them to be misused or smuggled. And so this is part of why this process is so drawn out, is there's been a lot of issues over the years with people pocketing the medications. One corrections officer described literally watching someone take one of the strips, pretend to put it in his mouth, and then drop it into the pocket of his jail-issued uniform. And so these are medications to treat opioid use disorder, but they're partial opioids themselves, and they can be misused, or in some cases, people are selling them to other people, because if you don't need to be treated for an addiction, like you don't actively have an opioid use disorder, you can theoretically get sort of high off of these medications. You can also, I mean, you can hoard them. They're just it's you introduce drugs into a jail and it gets slippery kind of immediately. And so there's all these precautions that they're taking. So they're crushing the pills, putting in a cup, they're putting it under their tongue, the prisoners, the corrections officer will literally sit there and stare at them and wait for that pill or the strip to dissolve. You know, they're doing like a tongue check. They're saying, drink a cup of water, eat a cracker, and then they go back. And so this can take, you know, it could take a few minutes or it can take 15 minutes. One of the corrections officers says, like, some people will really draw it out. Either because sometimes it just takes a while, or sometimes people just want a break and they sit there and let it take its time to dissolve. So, I mean, if you have the Piscataquis County Jail has a max capacity of, I believe, 36. If half of those people are on Suboxone, I mean, this could end up taking hours. And that's in addition to just the regular medications people might be taking. And this is all has to happen one by one because in a lot of these smaller jails, they just don't have medical staff or the time or the space to do this sort of en masse.
So they're having to like take hours out of every single day because this has to happen every day.
Yes.
So it's hours every day in addition to just all the other, things that folks are doing on a daily basis.
Yeah, so like at the Piscataquis County Jail, the officers that are doing this are the same officers that are doing bookings. So if a booking comes in, they have to pause MedPass and take care of the booking. If there's like, you know, a large arrest, like if there's multiple people coming in, this is really same at any of the jails that are on the smaller side. You know, the process has to pause. And so again, if you're on the 24-hour medication and you're supposed to you took your medication yesterday at 9 a.m. It's now 9:50 and another arrest just came in, like you now have to wait even longer. So yeah, I mean, Piscataquis is sort of a particular example because it is the smallest, but it's not entirely different at other jails. I mean, other jails do have medical staff, but they're still going one by one. It's still this like individual drawn out process that can take hours.
So at like Cumberland County Jail, for instance, I mean, how what percentage of the population are they doing this for? Like, how many people are they having to do this for, and how many medical staff do they have to manage that?
So Cumberland County is slightly different because it is the largest jail in the state. It has a max capacity of about, I think, 625. So they have a whole medical wing and medical staff. They have a contracted medical provider. And so in terms of the number of people, I mean, I off the top of my head, I'm not sure exactly how many they might have on medication-assisted treatment, but I can say that the former health services administrator at the jail did say that for about every 10 prisoners they have at least one detoxing off of drugs or alcohol. Now, detox is different, but that sort of gives you an indication of the number of people coming in who have some sort of active addiction that then needs to be treated. So you have 625, the daily capacity. I actually have the paper right in front of me. I could tell you what it is was last year. The average daily population last year was 396. So one out of every 10 out of 400, what's quick math, 40 people who are coming every day who are on detox. So that's just a small indication of the number of people who ultimately do need this treatment.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break here. If you are just joining us, you are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, I'm joined by health reporter Emily Bader, who recently published a series on addiction in Maine's jails. I want to get into some more specifics on the funding and providing coverage, but before we do that, you mentioned detox. The series also talks a little bit about how, jails are dealing with other medical needs. And some of these are really complicated, and some of them actually require folks to be in the hospital, but also supervised by, somebody from like a corrections officer. What has that looked like, particularly for smaller jails that maybe don't have the resources of Cumberland County, per se.
So basically, if someone comes in and they're really sick, most jails, in fact, I would say probably all of the jails do not have the medical facilities to care for someone who's really sick. If you can imagine, someone comes in, they are an injection drug user. There's an animal tranquilizer called xylazine that's very commonly found in a lot of street drugs, and that's causing these like really awful necrotic skin wounds. Those skin wounds then get infected and they need IV antibiotics. Jails are not able to provide those IV antibiotics on site, so then they have to transfer them to a hospital. And this is true even for Cumberland County. And so then that's taking an officer away from the jail who has to transport the individual. Sometimes an ambulance has to come. It really depends on the situation. But even once they're at the hospital, if they're admitted, they can't just be left alone. So then there's an officer or a sheriff's deputy that's at least one of them that has to be on site with them at all times. And county officials and sheriffs have said that this is costing them a ton of money. For example, last year, or between 2024 and 25, the Cumberland County Jail, let's see, Cumberland County Jail, the, sorry, Cumberland County Sheriff Kevin Joyce told me that last year, there were 24 prisoners from the jail that were admitted to the hospital, and they were there for an average of 6 days. And that cost the jail or the county nearly $61,000. And that's transportation, and then the cost of staffing of an officer detail, and then it ends up being overtime. So it's really expensive. And this is just, it's happening more and more often. That was one of the things that I asked every jail, how often they have to admit someone to, or they have to bring someone to a hospital. At a place like Piscataquis County Jail, which I believe has only four officers on duty at any given time, if one officer is gone, usually the jail administrator told me usually they're calling in like a part-time officer or like reserve. Sometimes they're calling people who are like retired and sort of on reserve. So it's a huge lift, regardless of the size of your jail, but it's of course felt even more heavily at the small jails.
I mean, I also imagine like some of these jails are pretty far away from hospitals, right? Or I mean, I don't know, maybe not.
Well, Piscataquis County Jail is like across the street, not literally, but very close to Mayo Hospital. But Mayo Hospital is very small. So if there's someone who has a more severe or a higher level of needs, like then they are probably going to Bangor. I think it really depends. I, off the top of my head, I can't imagine exactly where all of the hospitals are, but either way, I mean, someone has to bring them to that point. And there's only a certain number of hospitals in the state that are able to handle like really s serious illnesses. The smaller hospitals may or may not have the ability to do that. So it's a lift regardless.
Well, so let's I want to talk about Arusa County, the jail there, because one of the things I found really fascinating about the story was this little anecdote about how, in 2019, when the jails in Maine became legally required to provide medication-assisted treatment, Arusa County had a really hard time to actually trying to find somebody who would do this. So talk a little bit about the experience up there.
Yeah, so by way of background, in 2018, a woman from Madawaska sued the Aroostook County Jail because her attorneys basically contacted the she had an upcoming sentence. Her attorneys contacted the jail, said our client is on medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. She would like to continue that treatment while in jail. I think she had a 40-day sentence. And officials said, no, we only do that for pregnant people. We don't allow medication-assisted treatment because it's a controlled substance. So then she, her attorney sued. The ACLU of Maine soon joined as co-counsel. And the county fought it. So it ended up going all the way to the First District Court of Appeals in Boston. And eventually that court upheld the lower court's decision that the jail would in fact be in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act if they declined to allow this woman to continue her treatment. So this was really a landmark ruling because it made it all the way to the appeals court and then applied to most of New England. So now, after that point, all of New England counties and jails, carceral facilities had to provide this treatment. But at the time, the Arista County Jail Administrator, Craig Clossy, he's still there. He said in an affidavit that the Suboxone is generic versions. They were banned in the jail because of longstanding issues around smuggling. But also, they were finding it really, really hard to find someone to come to the jail to administer the medications. Rules around controlled substances were different then. There were federal regulations that changed during COVID. But at the time, that if a pr provider wanted to prescribe certain controlled substances, specifically buprenorphine, they had to obtain a special waiver from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. It's called an X waiver. And it basically they had to go through like a little bit of training, and then they got a different number on their DEA control number. But it wasn't, not every doctor could prescribe it. You had to go through this specific protocol. And Clossy said that they could not find anyone in the county who had it or who had it and was willing to come to the jail. He said they reached out downstate, nobody would come. The rules were also different because providers had to see patients in person. The rules around prescribing for controlled substances weren't changed until COVID. I think it was early COVID, and then the X waiver was removed, I think, in 2023. So he was saying it was just like they literally could not find anyone who was willing to come to the jail, who had the X waiver, and who was willing to oversee a medication-assisted treatment program for prisoners.
Because
And
they would have had to
he.
do it every day, right? This is not like a,
Yeah, I
yeah.
believe I don't think the pro I believe after the initial intake it could be done by a medical assistant or a nurse or something, but every new patient would have to be seen by a provider, which I mean there's people coming in every day, so it is
Right.
possible that that would have to happen. Either way, if you don't live near the Holton jail, like that would
Yeah.
be really difficult. A lot of the smaller jails that don't have a regular contracted medical provider just have contracts with local practitioners. So it's not their full-time job coming to the jail. But he even said, quote, nobody wanted to touch it. That's what he told me in April. So they, at the time, they basically felt like they were between a rock and a hard place. But after that change, they had to figure it out. And he said it took a little while, but obviously they got there.
And so now they are still doing this daily dosage, and they have somebody who is providing that coverage.
So they have a contracted medical provider, and because the X waiver no longer exists and you can do telehealth, it does make things a lot easier, but they do have providers that come to the jail regularly. They also have full-time nurses there, and those nurses are the ones that are doing the daily med pass, the daily medication administration.
So you can do the initial intake now via telehealth.
Yeah, you can. I think it differ diff I couldn't say for sure how every jail is doing it. They might be doing a mix of like telehealth and in person. I think it probably just depends on their provider schedule.
Well, we talked a little bit about this at the top of the episode, but we've been talking about this daily dose and how this is really complicated to administer. It takes a lot of time. You have the issue of potential withdrawal. If you're past 24 hours, it can be kind of anxiety inducing for people. But we've also mentioned that a couple of jails in Maine two have switched from this daily dose pill to a long-acting injectable shot, which provides about a month of coverage. Franklin County was one of those places. What have they seen as well? Take us through how long they've been doing that, what it's looked like there, and what are they starting to see as a result of this switch?
So the jail started this program last July. They switched from doing the daily medications to the long-acting injectables. And they did this with the help of a $1 million grant from the Department of Justice. It's shortened to COSIP. I could not probably tell you off the top of my head what the whole thing stands for, but it has to do with opioid use disorder in jails and prisons. But for whatever reason, the COSIP grant does not allow, you can't, the jail is not allowed to use that money to pay for the medications itself. So the jail ended up getting a grant from the Department of Public Safety and a grant from the Maine Recovery Council, which oversees half of Maine's opioid settlement money. Settlement funds, and that's how they're paying for the medications itself. The COSIP grant, the $1 million, paid for jail renovations. It paid for three staff members, and they're also doing a lot more officer training and education. Basically, it was paying for they revamped their re-entry program, which I think we're going to get to in a little bit. But getting back to the results, so far, one of the sergeants there who's in charge of the federal grant told me that morale among both the jail staff and the prisoners has improved vastly. Use of force incidents, where correctional officers are using force with prisoners, has decreased by half. Physical altercations between prisoners have gone down by more than 90%, according to the data they've collected so far. The jail recently sent its first year of data to the Cutler Institute at the University of Southern Maine for further analysis. But so what one of the sergeants was telling me, this is Ryan Close, because that daily medication is he described it as sort of a valuable currency. Like there's so much room for misuse or smuggling or hoarding, or one of the doctors even described, like, you imagine you are buying drugs off the street and you owe someone money and then you both end up in the jail together. Like people are getting bullied and told, like, you better pocket your drugs and give it to me because you owe me money. Like there's a lot of dynamics it creates, or it continues from the outside. And the long-acting injectable, because not only is it like you can't smuggle an injectable that goes under your skin, but it's lasting for a month, it's just reducing all of that tension among prisoners. And also there's just like not that 24-hour anxiety. It's just sort of like lifting the morale. And then because the jail also did a lot of training and education, they did, they wanted to educate corrections officer on the signs of addiction. They also wanted to teach officers about emotional intelligence, because basically what they were telling me, the people who designed this program, is they wanted to switch from a punitive system to a rehabilitative or restorative system. And so corrections officers are feeling better. I mean, I didn't get into this much, but depression and suicide among corrections officer and law enforcement officers is very high. And so if you give them the tools to deal with what they're seeing on a daily basis, it improves conditions. But simply because they're not doing, they have no more use of force, there's, well, not no more, but it's gone down. Physical altercations have gone down. There's less transports to hospitals because of injuries, less corrections officers out on workers' comp, which also costs money. So there's sort of a morale boosting and cost saving benefit that they have seen in just the first year.
A wide range of impacts from just this switch. And it also strikes me, I mean, when you were talking, and we are going to get into the funding in just a little bit, but when you were talking about the fact that the shot costs more, it sounds to me like actually it doesn't really cost more because there are a lot of externalities and a lot of other, time and staff time and all of these things that maybe make it comparable to a daily pill.
I mean, that is the argument that officials at Franklin County have made.
Yeah. We have about 5 more minutes before we have to take another break. But before we take a break, what does the future look like for Franklin County? I mean, that sounds like that funding may not last forever, right? What are they planning to do after that, and how long do they expect it to last?
So the COSIP grant is for 3 years. So 1 year is down already. So they have 2 more years. I'm just looking at my notes of how much they've spent so far. So the Department of Public Safety grant, they spent all of that. And they have spent about half, I believe, of the grant they received from the Maine Recovery Council. But something interesting that as I was going through the numbers with Ryan Close, he said in the first 6 months of the program, they spent over $100,000 on medication. In the second 6 months, they spent just over $33,000. And he said the USM will provide further analysis, but the jail staff's hunch is that there are simply fewer people coming back to the jail. Jails
Wow.
tend to be a revolving door. And when they started the program, they had a lot more people who had an addiction and needed this treatment. But then those people are getting released and they're not coming back because they've kind of been set down this different path where they have more resources. So that it's sort of ending that revolving door.
That's a huge difference. I mean, that's like a less than a third, right? Of the guys. So you said $100,000 and then the first 6 months, and then $33,000 the following 6 months on medication.
So, I mean, USM is still going to do their analysis, but
Yeah.
that's just like first blush. I mean, they're simply spending less money because there's fewer people in the jail who need the treatment. And they anecdotally they really believe that that's because people are just not coming, they're not getting arrested again.
Wow. Well, and these are really, I mean, you mentioned it I can't remember whose quote it is, but in the piece, you do talk about how like these are neighbors of the correctional officers, right? Like these are small communities. And so then, yeah, maybe there's something to that hunch, I guess.
Yeah, I think that was Sheriff Scott Nichols of Franklin County who said that. Or I think it was Elaine O'Connor who's the medical director of the Franklin and Somerset County programs, who was quoting the sheriff saying, "These are our friends and neighbors."
Yeah. We do need to take another break. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, I'm joined by health reporter Emily Bader, who has recently published a series on addiction in Maine's jails. So let's talk about funding. As we just mentioned right before the break, a lot of jails want to do this, but it is very expensive at the outset. Long-acting injectables cost more than twice as much, it sounds like, as the daily pill. Yeah. And you talked a little bit about Franklin County and how they are funding it. Now, Somerset County is the other jail that is also doing this long-acting injectable. How are they paying for it? And then if you could get into a little bit of the accounting for the staff time involved in the daily dosing, like what Do they have any idea how much staff time this is costing them? Like what the actual cost is?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
I just pulled up my handy dandy spreadsheet of funding that Somerset County has received. So Somerset County does not have the same COSIP grant from the Department of Justice that Franklin County has, but they got funding from the state through contracts to get this part get this program started. They also got $175 from the Maine Recovery Council. Actually, more than that. About twice as much as that, from the Maine Recovery Council to, or I'm sorry, $175,000 from the Maine Recovery Council, plus about just under $130,000 from the Somerset County's own pot of opioid settlement funds to pay for this. But basically, it's been through state grants, federal pass-through grants. So that's federal money that is awarded, given to the state, who then awards it to counties or other recipients. So since 2022, they've gotten about $3 million in funding for this program, just for for medication assisted treatment. But the continual identifying funding continues to be an issue. That's sort of the issue that I mentioned at the beginning, where state support has stayed about the same. I mean, that identifying funding is kind of where this entire project started. Every year, counties are kind of scrambling to figure out how they're going to pay for jails. Jails tend to account for about half of the county's entire budget. Usually it's like you'll see like a general fund and the jail fund. Jails are really expensive to run, and there's also a cap on the amount that counties can raise taxes year over year. So counties cannot raise taxes more than 4% year over year, specifically for taxes that go to the jails. So county officials basically say they feel hamstrung, that like they can't raise the taxes, they're not getting enough state support, and that's why they're turning to outside funding sources like opioid settlement funds to pay for this. But Franklin County, to sort of get back to your original question, Franklin County is, they have about 2 more years of funding, and then I think they're hoping that the first couple of years of this program have established what a cost-saving measure these long-acting injectables ultimately are, and so that they will be able to then justify this through the regular budget process, rather than getting outside funding to like start a pilot program, for example.
Is there any movement to do this? I'm thinking of Cumberland County in particular, just because it's the largest jail in the state. Are they also looking for outside funding to do something like this?
Cumberland County Jail actually has a COSIP grant as well. They are using it for reentry. I am hoping to get into that in a little bit more in future reporting, but they have not used it on the medi or they're not using it to create a new program like Franklin County. I mean, by officials in Franklin County's own admission, it's easier to start this sort of program in a place in a jail that has a maximum capacity of 39 versus Cumberland, which is 625. Obviously, there's not necessarily 625 people there every day, although sometimes it gets close. So it's more complicated logistically. But I mean, Kevin Joyce basically has that's the sheriff in Cumberland County. I mean, I think I may even be have quoted him somewhere. I know certainly other sheriffs at other larger jails like Penobscot County have said they would love to do something like this, but kind of wrapping their arms around the funding piece of it and just the planning piece of it is proven difficult. Whether or not advocates and experts think that it is possible, I think there's a lot of people that do think it's possible, but I think as of right now, they have not been able to do it.
Well, but the funding piece of it and the actual data collection of this was so fascinating. So you were you able to get a handle on the cost of providing substance use and mental health care for people in jails in Maine? Like, what does that actually cost every year?
Yes and no. I sent out 2 rounds of freedom of access requests to every single jail. asking for financials, like how much did you spend last year in the jail in total? How much did you spend on medical costs? How much did you spend on medication-assisted treatment? How much did you spend on hospital admissions? I also asked for demographics, prisoner demographics, like average daily population. That's just, I mean, that's self-explanatory. It's just the number of people on average per day in a year, usually. And number of people who are on medication-assisted treatment or received it throughout the course of a year. And responses varied. Two counties did not end up responding at all. That was York and Oxford. But elsewhere, I mean, there was just no uniformity in data collection. Jails every single day are required to submit their daily population to the state. So I knew that there, and there's some other state required collection processes. So I knew that there was certain data that they should have. But when you ask for them for that data, they it sort of sent some of them into a tailspin. Because I just it seemed like I mean, I think any other reporter in the state of Maine can relate to this, that like Maine loves paper. Maine does not like to put things on the computer, even if you do. I mean, I, for example, I ended up requesting quarterly medication-assisted treatment reports that jails have to submit to the Department of Corrections. I got some of those back. Some of the jails sent them to me themselves. They were like literally written by hand and then scanned. So it's like it's not even put into a computer
Right.
initially. So that's all to say, it was really hard to get any sort of data that I could use to compare. I mean, like good data processes, like I can't compare something when they're from two different people, if they're two different jails, if they are using two different metrics. I also went through every county's budget for the last couple of years. That also was a mess. Some counties will like break things down into really specific details, others will not. So that's all to say, I really tried to collect all this data and to varying degrees of success. I ended up using that County Correction Standards Council report I mentioned at the top of the hour for a lot of my data. This is a council of seven people from across the state. They did a report at the beginning of the year where they were looking specifically at how much jails are spending to provide basically what the cost drivers are. And looked at medication-assisted treatment and mental health, and they did do their own estimates of how much each jail is spending. And I talked to the person who put that data together. That's Tim Curtis. He's the Somerset County Administrator. He's on the council, and I asked how he did it, and he said he worked with every single county individually to come up with the sum.
Oh,
And
wow.
so each county still sort of potentially estimated differently. So York County, for example, included money that they spent to build a recovery center, and which is supposed to be which will be, you know, for people leaving the jail in part, as part of their like reentry process. So it wasn't just like straight cash spent in the jail. It was also like one time or like sort of ancillary spending on like addiction in among jail populations. So even that was it was the best and most complete estimate of spending that is available. I don't know the exact methodology behind it, but I mean, Tim was really great in just taking me through what he did, but still, that was like work he did with 15, actually, well, 16 counties, because Lincoln and Sagahawk share a jail.
So I mean the I think that the overall number as messy as it might be, was
Yes.
what did you
It
actually
was
come to?
well, so using the corrections report, in the fiscal year 2025, county spent about $9.1 million on medication-assisted treatment and about $3.5 million on mental health care. So about 12.6 million overall on those two items. And that includes not necessarily just the cost of like medication or of a provider. It kind of includes all these other elements. Something else I'll mention is, so jails are required to submit their spending. I believe it's monthly budget reports to the state. Those budget reports only include tax dollars spent. So
Oh, so not grant funding.
exactly.
Oh, so it's
So
not really a full accounting.
exactly. So that's why Tim worked with all of these counties to estimate this.
Yeah.
There's also no way it does separate by medical costs, but it doesn't go into like smaller subcategories like medication-assisted treatment. So there's just no way to like extrapolate those specific costs. Also, because a lot of counties kind of just, which I saw in my own data collection, a lot of counties will just consider, or they do medication-assisted treatment entirely through their contracted medical provider. So they're kind of not doing any accounting necessarily on how much time the medical provider is spending on it, time and money, because it's just built into their contract. So it's kind of like, kind of seems like not anyone truly knows what is going on.
Yeah, this is definitely a familiar problem for reporters in Maine.
Yeah.
I remember trying to collect getting data from the DEP one time on recycling, and they had got asked, 400 and some odd municipalities to submit recycling reports. They'd gotten 140 of those. Like, most of them were filled out by hand. They were really hard to read. They, like, there's a whole bunch of information missing. I mean, yeah, very familiar problem, I think, for anybody who's reported in Maine.
Yes.
We only have about 5 minutes left, and I realize we have not gotten to talk at all about sort of the post release, which is a huge part. There's an entire story on this. All the stories will be linked in the show notes so people can read them all. But let's just, in our last 5 minutes, talk about how, overdose rates tend to really go up there, after incarceration. How are jails trying to address that?
Yeah, so really quickly, when you go into jail, you're suddenly detoxed, you're not, taking drugs anymore, you lose tolerance. So when you're released, people might have an instinct to use the same amount of drugs that they used before, and they no longer have that tolerance, and then it's really dangerous. I mean, these are already drugs that are highly lethal, and then if you're using it the same amount you'd used before, don't have the tolerance, it can, there's really high rates of fatal overdoses. It's the leading cause of death among people who have been recently released from incarceration nationwide. So Franklin County, for example, with this information in mind, totally like revamped their reentry planning, because it's the time when you get out of, if you're released from a jail, you may not have family, you may not have any money, you probably don't have a job, like, and then having a criminal record makes all those things even more complicated. And if you're dealing with substance use disorder for which you need treatment or support, it's just like it's a really tenuous time. So Franklin County was really trying to basically take the successes they're finding within the jail with this injectable program and make sure that it continues once people leave. So that's getting people, making sure people are signed up for MainCare, getting them connected to a new provider. And because telehealth is so much easier now, it's a lot easier to get people connected to a telehealth provider who can then just set up their next shot at like your local pharmacy. Making sure they have housing sorted. So they're trying to like, get ahead of all of these challenges that people face so that when they leave, they're not just like, it's I've heard this over and over again. I heard it for this when I talked to sources for this story. I've heard it in prior reporting. When your addiction kind of leads you to sort of lose all of your family, your resources, you tend to just return to what you know, which might be the people you used with. It might be your drug dealer. So they're really trying to prevent people from just going back to those, for lack of a better word, old habits, and get started on the right path. And not every jail has the ability to do that, because it costs money. So Franklin County is really sort of has been sort of a it's been different in that respect. I believe Cumberland County is also working on it. That's what they're using their COSIP grant for. But a lot of jails don't have that ability. They just simply don't have the staff or the time.
Yeah, I was really struck by an example in the story of a man who volunteers to drive people from the jail. Yeah, tell us briefly. We've got 2 minutes. Tell us about him.
Yeah, that's Manny Reese. He's the Options Recovery Coach for Franklin County. Options is a program, a state program. He calls himself a sober taxi. He will offer to drive people to wherever they need to go. He will sometimes see people, like, he goes to the jail a few times a week to meet with people. And so if he sees someone getting someone released and they're literally walking down the street in downtown Farmington, he will pull over and be like, "Where are you going? You're not going to so and so's house, right? Like, get in the car. I will take you to where you need to go. Do you need money for a bus ticket? Do you need money to call someone?" So he really is, like, he's part of this sort of last step, trying to make sure people get to continue the successes they experienced in the jail.
Yeah. I think that's, he talked about like the just the last mile of getting people that last mile. Yeah. Well, there's so much more we could talk about, but it is, we are at the hour. I would urge everybody to go to themainmonitor.org and read the series. It is excellent. We'll also be doing an event around it in the coming months, so look out for more on that. We'll do a panel with some of the sources Emily talked to for the piece. You have been listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Main Monitor. The Main Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Main Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.